This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
We'll find out about the undocumented migrants seeking to sustain themselves and organize for better wages and benefits in South Korea.
But now,
a Filipina immigrant worker has brought suit against a former United Nations ambassador, his family, and his wife's travel agency for violating federal laws against human trafficking. Ivy Seriopis, who leads the anti-trafficking initiative of the Asian American Legal Defense and Education Fund, who filed suit on behalf of Marichu Suarez Bayonanan, joins us now, and I hope I've done justice to the names.
Balanan would be her last name.
Thank you. Why don't we begin by telling her story?
Ms. Balanan, originally from the Philippines, made an agreement with Norma Baja, who is the wife of the former ambassador, a permanent representative to the United Nations representing the Philippines, in exchange for 250,000 Philippine pesos, or approximately 5,000 American dollars. Ms. Balanan would have received transportation from Manila to New York, work authorization, a proper visa, and job placement assistance to find work as a nurse here in the U.S. She received schooling, education, graduated from a university in the Philippines with a nursing degree, and she had every intention of using that degree here in the U.S. Unfortunately, upon her arrival in the U.S., the Bajas leveraged an enormous debt, an additional 250,000 Philippine pesos, or $5,000, against her, and because she didn't have the money, they said that she had to work off that debt as their domestic worker in their household.
That takes me into the question of who is being trafficked. And many people think of trafficking almost entirely as just sexual exploitation. It's clearly broader than that. What are some of the categories of work that are part of that trafficking experience?
Well, trafficking is definitely more about the emphasis on the condition of involuntary servitude, forced labor, and slavery, essentially the working conditions of a person once they're already trapped in a particular industry, usually a low-wage industry. And the industries range from not only the sex industry, but also restaurant work, farms, households for, you know, domestic workers specifically. Some people are trafficked to beg or commit crimes. The range of industries runs the gambit. But essentially, it is much more complex and comprehensive than what is properly known. It's not just about sex trafficking.
And Ivy, the forces that drive people into being trafficked, what are they? What are the politics behind it?
Certainly, a number of trafficked persons end up in that kind of situation when they make the decision to ultimately migrate in the first place, because discrimination oftentimes in their country of origin, particularly against women, they are forced into also contributing to the family income by engaging in work. With sex discrimination in schools or in the workplace, they are forced to migrate to other countries where they might have more opportunities, and are forced into this tragic situation of possibly being trafficked. Also, just the forced migration in general of impoverished countries with people who are forced to move no matter what has exacerbated the problem. And it doesn't help that countries like the U.S. or other countries have tightened their immigration laws as opposed to making it more open to migrants, leaving migrants no other choice but to oftentimes be tricked or forced or coerced into situations where they have to migrate through more clandestine means.
Now, you've made a distinction when we've talked previously between smuggling and trafficking. What is that point of differentiation? Is it just that somebody comes here legally versus not legally, or is it deeper than that?
Well, oftentimes smuggling is conflated with trafficking, and that's definitely not the case. Smuggling involves a choice of a traveler who knowingly crosses international borders without any kind of authorization, whereas a trafficking situation might involve smuggling at the beginning, but like I said, the emphasis is more about the condition of work that they find themselves upon arriving here. One scenario might involve someone who makes an agreement with snakeheads in China to come here to the U.S., say a parent who make an agreement to send their child over here, and the child then is saddled with responsibility of paying off an enormous debt to satisfy the snakehead's needs. In that kind of situation where a child had no choice in the matter, was trapped and now is stuck in what's called debt bondage or peonage, that kind of situation might be trafficking. Another situation could involve a case like Ms. Balanon, where she had valid papers. The former diplomat, Mr. Baja, helped her get a visa, and she was here with proper immigration authorization, yet she was still in a trafficking situation.
Now, it would appear certainly what we hear fairly constantly now on the news is that the trafficking really predominantly involves women. So tell us more about the patterns of the women that are trafficked. What should we understand about them and perhaps the forces of discrimination, et cetera, that create this forced migration?
There's often discrimination in many of these countries of origin. From my work specifically, the largest group that I'm aware of, that people who are trafficked come from Asia and the Pacific Islands. These countries have restrictive laws that make it very difficult for women to be socioeconomically mobile, and also because the families as a unit do not make enough with one income earner, the woman is forced to work but then can't afford to adequately contribute to the family income because there are not enough opportunities for her. So oftentimes mothers, wives, sisters have to migrate in order to try and contribute to the family income. Oftentimes you'll see with any migrant, including trafficked persons, they come here with the full intent of earning money so they can remit money back home to their families.
Ms. Balanon was employed by, in quotes, a former United Nations ambassador from the Philippines. Who was that ambassador, and what are her claims now in the litigation that has ensued from her case?
The former ambassador was a former permanent representative to the United Nations from the Philippines, Mr. Lauro Baja, his wife Norma Baja, their adult daughter Elizabeth Facundo, and Norma Baja's travel agency, Liber Travel Incorporated, I believe is the full name. What had happened there was this couple had made an agreement with her to use their status, particularly Mr. Baja's status, to get her a visa in order to come to the U.S. Ms. Balanon was under the impression that this was all proper and legal, that she would be receiving work authorization and a visa so that she could work as a nurse. Rather, the visa that they had brought her in with was through the diplomatic visa that Mr. Baja had.
And at this time, there is a federal lawsuit that you have engaged through the Asian American Legal Defense and Education Fund. I assume that some of her claims have to do with back wages and damages.
Oh, yes. In terms of the claims against him and the rest of his family and the Liber Agency are violations of the Trafficking Victims Protection and Reauthorization Act. In 2003, Congress allowed trafficking survivors, in addition to any kind of criminal investigation or prosecution that occurs, is allowed to bring a civil suit. In addition to any trafficking claims, we're also bringing claims for violating federal as well as state wage and hour laws, racketeering, and relevant tort suits.
And how prevalent is the issue of trafficking, and how impactful will be this suit if you prevail on that issue?
Well, unfortunately, many of the statistics involving trafficking internationally as well as in the U.S. are guesstimates. International organizations estimate that trafficking is much more prevalent than federal statistics denote, but even federal statistics show that internationally trafficking is in the hundreds of thousands, whereas to the U.S. specifically, it ranges from 16 to 18,000, many of whom, like I said before, come from Asia and the Pacific Islands. And in terms of this case and what it can do for trafficking survivors is that it'll show, one, for example, that diplomats who have historically operated with impunity, this is not the first case of diplomats who have exploited workers. There have been several cases that have been brought to court in the past. This is a little bit different, though, in terms of the fact that she was defrauded into thinking she was going to be a nurse, and she actually paid an exorbitant sum in order to come work here. And certainly not only on the diplomat front, but also of domestic work and domestic labor, the kind of exploitation and degradation and humiliation that happens in a situation where domestic workers are alone in the household. If there are migrants, they can't speak the language, they don't know the laws that protect them, they're isolated. This will be an opportunity for them to realize that they do have rights and they can assert themselves against perpetrators of trafficking or even federal wage and hour laws.
And people who want more information, where can they go?
They can call us at 212-966-5932. Or if they have access to the internet, they can visit our website at www.aaldef.org. We have several brochures and materials in 12 languages, including English, on our website.
Ivy Sariopoulos from the Asian American Legal Defense and Education Fund, and she leads the anti-trafficking initiative of ALDEF. Thank you for joining us, and we'll continue to apprise our listeners of the progress of this litigation.
Thank you for having me. Dahil mithila di palayain, bawat isa sa pag-alipin. Sa hitlama ng gutom, kahirapan, pasakit, hinding-hindi tayo susuko. Kahit na may bagyo, kahit na may ulos, kahit may libo-libong kaaway, kahit na magabi at isang matira, sa ating dakilang hanay, tayong manggagawa. At magsasaka, sambayanan ay muling babangon, ipagtatagumpay ang bawat labanan sa buong daigdig. Kahit kadalanan ng libong armas, ang ating mukbo ay hindi atras. Lakas ng masa ang ating sandigan, saan mang larang at digmaan. Kahit na may bagyo, kahit na may unos, kahit may libo-libong kaaway, kahit na magabi at isang matiraw sa ating dakilang hanay.
A little worker-based music from South Korea, because that's where we're heading now. Across the globe, workers have been forced from their home, from their countries in search of a livelihood. We'll find out about one such group of workers, the undocumented migrants seeking to sustain themselves and organize for better wages and benefits in South Korea. It's some strategic information that sounds tremendously analogous to what's happening here in our own country. Joining us from South Korea to tell the stories of these workers, Awolson Liam, the International Solidarity Coordinator of the MTU, who will be translating for the General Secretary of MTU, Vijay Gorong, and we welcome both of you.
Hi, this is Wilson. It's good to be with you.
Begin with the issue of the migrant workers. How do they come to South Korea? Who are they? And what are the conditions that they face?
이주 노동자 달리 처음에는 다른 나라 돈 거래에 의해서 나왔지만은 다 이주 노동자들 한국 오면서 돈 거래에 의해서 나왔습니다. 처음에는.
Well, migrant workers first come to Korea because they need to earn money. They come from poor countries. In my case, I came to Korea from Nepal in 1992 in October, and I came on a tourist visa, so I've been working in an undocumented status.
What kind of work do the migrants do, and how many workers are we actually speaking about?
지금까지 한국에 와면서 이주 노동자들 일하는 거는 아주 나쁜 쪽으로 더러운 거 dirty, danger, difficult라고.
Migrant workers work mostly in small manufacturing or construction and some services, but particularly they work in 3D industries, so dirty, difficult, dangerous, where they're often hurt, where they have to deal with very smelly and difficult work. And that's the situation for migrant workers in Korea right now. You know, up until a few years ago, we said about 400,000, but the number now is actually about 620,000, both undocumented and documented migrant workers. And on the one hand, the government is bringing more and more migrant workers in through, like, what's very similar to a guest worker program, a short-term, short visa rotation program, at the same time as it's carrying out a very heavy crackdown against undocumented or, you know, so-called illegal migrant workers. And so the numbers right now are about 620,000.
I want to talk more about that employment permit system because it has also enormous implications for here, where certainly the Bush administration is very intent on a system of guest workers. What is that system? How does it work? And how does it affect the migrants that come to South Korea? Again, the employment permit system. How does that work?
관광화재 관련해서 지금 한국 정부가 우리 관광화재 법을 만들면서 한국에 들어온 거 이주 노동자들 아예 트레이드 없는 일만 하고 있지만은 그런 거 이주 노동자들한테 보장해야 되는데 보장 아예 못 하고 있고요.
When the government first introduced the employer permit system, which we call EPS, in 2004 it was started, they said that this was going to protect the rights of migrant workers, but in fact it does not do that in any way. One of the most important things that General Secretary just emphasized was that migrant workers come on for a three-year visa only. They have to sign contracts with an employer ahead of time in their country of origin through a government agency, and then they work for only 3 years, and then they have to go back to their country, or they become undocumented. And recently there's been a revision so that if they have an invitation by their employer, they can go back to their country for a month and then come back and work for 2 more years only, but that's only if they have an invitation from their employer, which is not the majority. So migrant workers come often with this dream of being able to make money to support their families, also to pay off debts that they incurred in the migration process, and then because of the three-year limitation, they completely can't do that at all. And I'm just going to add a few things also that the system ties migrant workers to their employers, so technically, by law, you're not supposed to change employers. In fact, you can go through a process of, you know, getting approval from the employer and from the Ministry of Labor and change employers during the three-year period, but it's very restrictive, and it's restricted to only 3 times. So because the conditions at most of the workplaces are very, very poor, migrant workers will frequently change workplace, use up the 3 chances that they have very quickly, and then be stuck again with a very bad employer, and then still have, you know, a year left or so on their visa, but not be able to do anything about the conditions that they're working under. So that's one of the things that we see as a very severe restriction on labor rights. Another thing is that migrant workers, they have yearly contracts, so they have to renew their contract every year, which means that they're constantly looking out for the judgment of their employer and end up having to submit to less than standard, substandard labor conditions because they're afraid that they're going to lose their contract or it won't be renewed the next year. These are some of the things that we see as, you know, high restrictions on what the labor rights of migrant workers, despite the fact that the government has supposedly said that it's protecting the labor rights equally to the rights of Korean workers.
We should just mention again that we're talking roughly as a whole about 620,000 migrant workers, and of that, there are roughly 220,000 of them that are undocumented on top of that from at least 100 different countries. So the magnitude of the issue is significant. Well, one of the exciting things has been that the MTU has begun an organizing process, and as we're pleased to talk with the General Secretary and find out that he also is a migrant worker who is the leader of this very important union. If you can tell us a little bit about the MTU formation and its process of organizing the undocumented migrant workers as a union.
이주 노조 왜 만드는 거 얘기가 나오면요. 우리가 한국에 처음에 한국 올 때는 이주 노동자들 나온 거 이유는 돈 벌기 위해서 나왔지만은 한국에 와가지고 처음에는 2년 동안 어떻게 살 수 있을까 생각했지만은 살다 보면 너무 오래됐고 살다 보면
Migrant workers, as I said before, come, you know, basically to try to earn money, and they face really, really difficult working conditions where they're not paid wages. You know, wages are delayed or unpaid. They're hurt, but, you know, they were not offered industrial accident insurance for a while. They face discrimination in comparison to Korean workers in terms of forced late overtime, wage difference, verbal and physical abuse, all sorts of things. And so we realized that the only way for us to continue to be able to work and live in Korea was to fight for our rights and try to improve this situation. And that's the reason that migrant workers came together to make form the migrant trade.
Now, I understand that there's been a targeted crackdown against the leaders of the MTU. Can you tell us about that?
지금 우리가 한국 오하면서 이주 노조 만들어놓은 거 이해로 해면서 한국 정부가 우리한테 무조건 많이 단합하고 있습니다. 그러면 우리가 이거 이주 노조가
MTU was formed in 2005 by undocumented migrant workers in Korea. Since our formation, it's been the position of the government that it shouldn't have to recognize a union that's formed by undocumented migrant workers. So it's using that as an excuse to carry out very, very severe repression against the union.
그래서 우리는
There is a very strong crackdown against undocumented migrant workers' raids and detention and deportation of undocumented migrant workers that's going on against, you know, just in general in Korea right now, and this is something that MTU has to fight and will continue to fight. But I just want to add and say one of the tactics that the government has used, because MTU's officers are undocumented migrant workers, the government targets them for crackdown, for arrest, detention and deportation. So the immigration authorities under the Ministry of Justice will identify where our leaders live or where they work and then send 15 or 20 immigration officers to stand guard even overnight in front of their house or their workplace. And then when they leave the building, ambush them, arrest them, hold them in a detention center, and then deport them as quickly as possible. So recently, both last November, our president, vice president, general secretary were arrested in that manner and then deported, you know, very secretly in the middle of night because there was a lot of interest and attention and support, and so the government very secretly deported them. And then again, the exact same thing happened after we elected a new president, vice president, and general secretary. The vice president and president were ambushed and arrested on May 2nd, the day after Labor Day. The president was coming out of the MTU office, and they were kept in a detention center outside of Seoul, which is unusual for crackdowns or arrests that happen in Seoul. And then we had made a complaint to the National Human Rights Commission, and the National Human Rights Commission said, yes, there's a good chance that there are human rights violations here. So they issued a recommendation with force, with binding force, that there should have been a stay of detention where until the investigation was complete, these people should not be deported. And that very same day, the immigration officers under the auspice of the Ministry of Justice, and we believe the president, were taken out of their cells and then whisked to the airport and deported. And so this is one of the forms, the most sort of violent and also quite difficult, detrimental forms of repression that the government is carrying out against us.
Well, Wilson, we have to draw to a conclusion this interview, but as we do that, why don't you summarize for us the significance of this issue, which is clearly the right to organize, the right to humanize.
In international conventions, including UN conventions and ILO conventions, the right of all workers, regardless of social status, to form and join labor unions of their choosing is protected. And this is true in the South Korean constitution, too. I mean, it's been those, you know, international conventions like the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination have been shown to apply to undocumented migrant workers. So MTU, when we were formed, the government said we can't recognize a union that is formed by undocumented migrant workers. We started a legal battle, and we won a judgment at the Seoul High Court, which said, yes, undocumented migrant workers have the right to form unions. MTU should be recognized. And this, we believe, is a precedent not only for migrant workers in South Korea, but for migrant workers who are attempting to organize in the United States, in other Asian countries, all over the world. And that was really, you know, a victory for us, and yet the Ministry of Labor appealed to the Supreme Court. So there's a Supreme Court decision pending on the same issue. should MTU be recognized, do undocumented migrant workers have the right to freedom of association? It's gotten attention from the ILO, which is very supportive. It's gotten attention from other unions and human rights organizations, Amnesty International, around the world. And so we are waiting for this Supreme Court decision. We're actually asking for international solidarity. There's a sample statement in support of MTU and the right of undocumented migrant workers to join, form and join unions on the blog mtuintlnews.blogspot.com. There's a sample letter and numbers where you can fax to the Supreme Court.
From South Korea, Wilson Liam, the International Solidarity Coordinator of the MTU, translating for the General Secretary of MTU, Vijay Gorong, the MTU, the undocumented migrants seeking to organize for better wages and benefits in South Korea. I'd like to thank you for listening. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report.